It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, we are back for another edition of Terry's Talking Podcast. I'm David Campbell, sports manager at Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer, and alongside, as always, Terry Pluto, award-winning columnist from The Plain Dealer and Cleveland.com. Terry, how you doing?
I am well, David.
Good. We have a lot to go through today, including we got some great responses to your idea last week about famous athletes or notable people that we have all played against during our younger days. We got some really good responses to that, including some pancake references, and pancakes okay. Makes everything better, Terry. So, but anyway, let's talk about the Cavaliers, the red hot Cavaliers, 34-22. They're number four in the East. They're actually two games behind the Sixers right now, and they're only five behind the Celtics, who are in first place. That was some game last night in Washington, wasn't it, Terry?
Yeah, you put the last 96 minutes together, or the Pacer game and that one, it's extremely impressive. I mean, Washington was without a couple of their guys, but still, we've been banging away on the theme of get the ball to the big man, get the ball to the big man. And it's amazing what happens when you do that, because they shoot a high percentage and it just gets them more involved. I think they're better on defense when they see the ball on offense. You don't have to put as much pressure on your guards too to score all the time. So I love the way they defended and moved the ball. It was really just – I'm lumping those two games together into one long game of how the Cavs should play. And to me, that's exciting. And for all the talk about, you know, yeah, the gnashing of teeth or whatever when they win one, lose one, as you mentioned, what is it, five behind the Celtics now and a couple behind Philadelphia?
So, Terry, you mentioned the big men, and there's some Robbie Fenbruce, who does some Cavs behind the numbers posts. Jared Allen went 10 of 13 from the field last night.
Yeah.
And it's the sixth time in the last eight games that he has shot 70% or better. And it's the fourth time in the last eight games that he shot 75% or better. And he's fifth in the league in shooting percentage with 64.7%. And Robbie's got that all in a post that went up today. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the Wizards were talking about this after the game last night. It's like job one is putting pressure on Mitchell and Garland, but then you do that and you've got to worry about the pick and roll and all these guys flying down the lane. And this is the best you've seen the Cavs this season. Would you agree with that?
Probably in that stretch. Yeah. Now, when we talk about him shooting, you know, 70% or more, last year he shot 68% from the field. I'm talking about Jared Allen. In 2020 and 21, he shot 68% from the field. Exactly, by the way, 6-7-7. So he's never shot as a pro since his second year in the league. The lowest he's ever shot is 61%. So you look at that, and what that tells you is two out of three times when he shoots the ball, it's probably going to go in, because he's very careful when he shoots it and where he shoots it from. What I like, he's using his left hand more. And then, of course, he's a force defensively that, you know, is exciting. And now when you kind of look at some of their stats along those lines, and you look at what they're – Evan Mobley's shooting 55% from the field now. And Jarrett's up to 65%. So you have those two. I mean, Garland's got his shooting percentage up to 46. So it's really been it's been impressive. Actually, Dean Wade is better than I thought at 46%. So I don't want to just overwhelm with numbers, but the idea being that, yeah, 3 points are better than two, but what's our line? 2 points are better than none. And also when you go inside, remember that when Jared Allen misses, he causes such havoc on that end that oftentimes it's an easy lane for another person, probably Mobley or somebody else, to get a rebound. And also big men draw fouls too, and that helps you. So there's a lot of good things when the big guys shoot and score. But Robin Lopez wanted to be in it. He wants it on the record that he has shot 64% this year.
He Mark is.
I'm 34 for 53. He'll probably tweet it out. Remember the night that I think that when Donovan Mitchell went for 71, I think he tweeted out he and Mitchell combined for 72 points that night.
Yep. A classic tweet. So, hey, so Terry, during the season, there's always, I don't know, 3 to 5, kind of a handful of moments that kind of define a season for a team. And I know the Cavs have won 3 in a row now, but I'm thinking about that loss to Miami last week. It was 197, but the Cavs played a full 48 minutes against a good team with a deep culture and played defense at a playoff level and almost won that one. And even though they didn't win, I'm kind of wondering when we get to the end of the season if we're going to look back at that game against the Heat and think that was when things clicked.
And
what do you
also
think about that?
That game, well, you had the Mitchell fight, which is always fun to look at with Memphis. That game also showed them sort of a bit of the fallacy. Remember, they were relying on the three-point. That was a shot. That was a night where they took I think it was 44 threes and like 40 from two-point range, and they shot like, you know, 65% on one and like 2% on the other. I mean, I think they were like 11 for 43 or something on those threes. And then I think they looked at that and said, why were we not going inside more? And that is a thing that changed. And let's take some of the pressure off the guards for the scoring. And I also believe that Garland and Mitchell, they're not just out there playing for their stats. I don't see that in them. Frankly, they both have long-term max contracts. It's not like they need to add a couple of points to their scoring average for a financial reason. So this is more of the team approach. I think it's more what JB envisioned.
So, Terry, we've been talking off and on about the trade deadline coming up here. And Chris Fedor, our colleague who covers the Cavs, has a really interesting story today with Caris LeVert. And boy, you think with all the social media and these guys being on their phones that they would be checking every trade rumor. And you know, Caris LeVert is one of the players who's been mentioned as a possibility that the Cavs might try to move if they wanted to upgrade. And he's basically saying, I don't look at any of that stuff. I'm planning on being here unless they tell us otherwise. And, you know, he's just kind of rolling with it and he's planning on being a Cav the rest of the season, which I thought was really interesting because a lot of these guys take the opposite approach. But you look at the way this last week has gone, and you've kind of been saying that the Cavs would be fine standing pat. And this probably just even adds more credence to what you've been saying, is just take it easy. Don't go crazy at the trade deadline. Not that they have a lot of assets anyway, but this is just another reason, right? This recent play in your mind, or how do you feel about the trade deadline?
Well, I just got him up. So he was traded. He was a Brooklyn quite a bit earlier in his career. Then on January 13th of 21, so basically 25 months ago, he was traded that point to Indiana. He actually was in that huge deal that brought Jared Allen to Cleveland as four teams. Then February 7th, today, in fact, only it was a year ago, he was traded to the Cavs. So then if you turn around, you know, right now, so no one, he probably isn't checking it because he's been traded a couple times and realize you have nothing you can do about it. Now, there's Chris outlines it in the story, and I'm not going to talk at length about it because it gets too confusing. But if they keep him and he walks away as a free agent, it kind of messes their salary cap up. If they use him as an asset to bring in a player under contract for next year, it'll help them. And that's why I still think there's a chance he might be traded for somebody like Malik Beasley, a shooter who, while isn't the all-around player that LeVert is, might fit actually a little better. And also, if nothing else, he's under contract for next year. So I wouldn't be shocked if they did that. But you know, it's just not a it's not a major deal. You know, you look at LeVert and he's really tried hard to fit in, but I just think it's been a difficult go for him. You know, it's actually his 3-point shooting is the best it's been for his career, 37%. I don't know. I'm not a big fan of him. And that, but it's nothing personally, because like I said, he's trying to fit in. He clearly is a good, as they say, culture guy, but his game is too much with the ball.
Well, and JB Bickerstaff has really been trying to pump him up. I mean, after the game last night, talking about how he's a starter, he's an NBA starter, but for us, he's not, and we're really lucky to have him. And so I think they're trying to make it so that if he does stick around, he'll feel like he's got an important role on the team. So,
And JB's is good at that. I wrote about that for the last weekend. You know, when he came out and kind of had this defense of his team, and some people took it as him being thin-skinned. If you read it, it could sound that way. If you listen to it, you could find it, you know, there. You listen to his tone of voice. He was talking clearly to his players. That's how I saw it, because it wasn't a let's rip the media kind of thing. It was more of reminding his guys, oh, wait a minute, we're still pretty good here. And also, he is demanding for them to play this defensive style on a team that is so young. Young guys like to run around, shoot, score, pile up numbers. They don't want to hear about defending and switching and all this kind of stuff that he's been selling since day one. So I believe that that's another reason he wanted to circle the wagons around his players to kind of like stay the course.
And Terry, just by way of reset here for our listeners, the trade deadline is at 3 o'clock on Thursday, and the Cavs are without their 2023 pick, which, as you mentioned, was in the Caris LeVert trade. Assuming the Cavs make the playoffs, that'll go to Indiana, their first rounder. And then 25, 27, and 29 all went to Utah in the Donovan Mitchell trade. So
basically, they can't trade a pick for they can't trade a pick forever, because you can't, you have to have a pick every other year in the first round, unless they happen to acquire one in some other major deal. I mean, look, these guys have surprised me in the past. Now, the LeVert thing was rumored last year. I remember that. But the Mitchell trade seemingly came out of nowhere. The Jared Allen deal came out of nowhere. So a number of their big trades, they kept the lid on them and just kind of sprung it on everybody. So the fact we haven't heard anything, they still may do something.
You never know with the Cavs. They're always looking. So, Terry, I wonder if we should, can we talk for a few minutes about Isaac Okoro as he relates to Kevin Love? We got Caleb Mackey from Columbus, is a longtime listener of the pod, and he says, hey, Terry and David, do you guys have any thoughts as to why Kevin Love has not been playing lately? He's not been shooting well since his thumb injury, but it seems like he's healthy now, as far as I can tell. Could they potentially be trying to get him healthy for a trade? Probably not, but we can get into that. My hope is they're getting him healthy for the stretch run. He has the most playoff experience of anyone on the roster. Veterans like him are indispensable come playoff time. So Isaac Okoro has just been getting this of late. He shot well last night, and he's made 23 of his last 45 three-point attempts in the last 15 games, and that's over 51%. Are these two things related in your mind, or are they just kind of independent?
I think they're mostly independent, because Okoro is shooting guard / small forward, and his value is on the defensive end. It's nice that he's making threes, because that, if you notice, like my guy Lamar Stevens has sort of lost his job to Okoro. He doesn't play much at all. Love's situation is JB worries a little bit about Love and the pick and roll defense and that kind of stuff. So if he's not shooting very well, then I think JB tends to go away from him. I'm just kind of looking at some of Okoro's numbers, and it's really pretty good. I mean, if you go all the way back, really, since January 1st, and that's 19 games. I mean, he's shooting like 49% on threes, and it's just, and he's tough defensively. You know, he's one of the early junkyard dogs. Kevin is an interesting discussion because of the value that he mentioned about his experience And last year when he was healthy and scoring and really drawing those charges, and he was a big part of really helping JB get those guys around to, this is how we're going to play. But, you know, this is a sort of a throwback to 2 years ago. He can't stay healthy. He struggled. The difference is he's not, remember how, you know, basically he was kind of pouting a couple years ago. This has not been that, but he's just not really been able to get anything going at all. I mean, that's an asset they could trade. You know, you hate when your person is related to an asset, but that's how they talk in the NBA. At this point, if somebody wanted to take his contract, you know, I believe it's $28 million, and then turn around and trade the Cavs a player that would fit in for this year or next year. So they did that with Ilgauskas a number of years ago. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And they could do that with Kevin. But I haven't heard anything about Kevin. Brian Windhorst is a good friend of mine in that, and he's not heard anything about Kevin. He's at ESPN. He's more plugged in than I am. Chris has not heard anything about Kevin. You know, he's extremely plugged in with us. So the two basketball writers I trust the most, you know, Fedor and Windhorst, haven't heard anything, and I haven't heard anything. Because I think when you look at the tape, it's not real good right now.
Well, and that is a big salary to match. I mean, for sending him out of town, and what would you get back? And there'd probably be some more money coming back for something like that.
Oh, yeah. You'd probably take a, what they say, quote unquote, a bad contract back, but a guy you kind of liked, that sort of stuff. But it's been a hard go for him.
I mean, and Terry, we've been talking about with Isaac Okoro making three pointers. I mean, one of Kevin Love's real values on the offensive end is helping to space the floor for everybody else. And if Isaac Okoro is hitting those corner threes, that is part of what Kevin Love's job description is those corner threes.
Yeah. So
Okoro can get to the rack. Like he can take the ball to the rim in a way that Kevin Love can't. And you have the defense like you were just talking about. And I think that's why JB's going to him a little bit right now.
All right, since January 1st, Kevin Love is shooting 303 from the field. And basically that's 23 of 76. And on three-point range, he's shooting 23%. So he's just not making any shots at all. He's not even going down the low block. Now, maybe that thumb is preventing him from catching the ball, you know, in traffic and scoring. And then he's had the back thing and all that. It's too bad because I was hoping they could have another Love renaissance year. Because, boy, would that be perfect on this team, because they need the old stretch four, you know, the power forward that makes the long shots. And as you do mention, that Okoro's giving him some of that and other things too. So that they really are hoping Dean Wade can be the guy. They're very high on Wade. You know, they thought he was kind of a poor man's Lauri Markkanen. And I go back to the day they traded Markkanen. And Chris Fedor and I were just talking to a couple of the coaches. It was a background talk afterwards. And Sidney Lowe, one of the assistant coaches, was talking to us about that. And we were going through some of the guys. And Lowe goes, now, don't forget Dean Wade. We really like Wade. You know, he was coming along. He's 6'10". He can make some threes. And that was put out there for a reason.
And it's been coming to pass as of late.
They were going to go with him, and then he got hurt, and he got hurt again. I think he had a shoulder and then an ankle. So they want to go along. A lot of those minutes are going to Dean Wade also. But, I mean, look at those numbers on Kevin. I mean, they're bad.
Well, Terry, you know how it works in the NBA, and just to go back to what Caleb was writing here, things change quickly, and there might be, I mean, Kevin Love might go from being a healthy scratch last night to being an important piece down the road if someone turns an ankle or something, and all of a sudden things change. So we shall see, but certainly not the season Kevin Love had intended. So Terry, another big thing we need to talk about this week, LeBron James will be breaking Kareem's all-time NBA scoring record. It's interesting. I don't know if you saw this post, but I wanted to point out to the listeners, but Mary Schmidt-Boyer, who used to cover the Cavs for the Plain Dealer for a long time, a great NBA writer, shot me an email last week, and she's like, hey, Wayne Embry predicted this 15 years ago. And I'm like, really? And so I went back and I found the story, and sure enough, 15 years ago this week, Wayne Embry, in a story that Mary wrote, predicted that LeBron was someday going to break the record. And here we are 15 years after he said that. Of course, Wayne Embry, longtime general manager for the Cavs and around the NBA and a Hall of Famer. And I just thought that was remarkable. But what do you think of LeBron's ascension to the scoring crown this week, and any other thoughts you have on LeBron? It's kind of a momentous week in the NBA.
Well, I have a long story going up tomorrow talking about my memories of LeBron, because I grew up in Cleveland. I've lived in Akron since the middle 80s, and because I was working at the Beacon Journal for years, and I was at the Beacon Journal when he was doing all his stuff at St. Vincent St. Mary's. So I watched the whole ascension of it, and a guy who never cared about winning the scoring title, and he never did, is going to become the all-time winning scorer. Michael Jordan, and I know Phil Jackson mentioned this and some others. I can't remember who else I talked to with the Bulls. It might have been Jerry Krause or somebody like that. What's that? You know, Michael's a great teammate, all that, but he wanted to win that scoring title. So at the end of that regular season, he kind of watched the last month, and if he had to start racking up some 40-point games to make sure he won it, he won it. And so that was the thing that mattered. The only year that that's 2008 and 9 is when LeBron won the scoring title. But that was really he just kind of needed to do it that year because the team wasn't very good. I'm looking here. Michael won 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 8 in a row. Then he went and played only part of a year for baseball, and then he won 3 more in a row. So he won 11 in a row. That is not by accident. The man wanted to win the scoring title. And perhaps he wanted also to, you know, pass Kareem. He didn't get to do that. And here's LeBron, who, he liked to score his 25 or whatever, but that wasn't what he was about. It wasn't what he was about in high school. I mean, think about this. He averaged 28, 29 his last 2 years in high school. He scores 25 in his first NBA game. I mean, what could he have scored in high school? Once in a while, we'd throw in 50 just to show he could do it. But I remember games where they were telling him to shoot more because they were in a tight game against one of these nationally ranked teams. Another time I saw LeBron, they were playing in this tournament in New Jersey, and I forgot where the team was from, probably Los Angeles, but the player on the team was Trevor Ariza, and at that point he was a very hyped high school kid, and he played in the NBA for quite a while, Trevor Ariza, and LeBron, this was when once in a while he'd go out, and he just did it for a half. He went at Trevor Ariza in this showcase game and just destroyed him in the first half. Then Ariza's out warming up for the second half, and I don't know who this person was to Ariza, but he comes down by the court, and he is, and it's clearly somebody that knew him, whether it was a relative or something. You stink. You're soft. All that. That James just, you know, all that sort of stuff. And at that point, LeBron's team was up big, and I think he kind of coasted to 35. But he just showed, and Ariza was a broken man, by the way, or a young man at that point, what he could do at different times. One of the few players that, when LeBron really went at him, that didn't back down. There was another game. This is when he was a junior. He played against Oak Hill, and I was at this game, and Carmelo Anthony, maybe he's either junior or sophomore year, I forgot which, but he wasn't a senior. They went against Oak Hill, Carmelo Anthony, and they both scored in the middle 30s. It was a great game. Oak Hill won at the end. LeBron missed a jumper that could have won the game for St. Vincent St. Mary. So those were one of the few guys that could stand up to him, because physically when he wanted to turn it on, he was dominating. But, you know, he had kind of the scoring talent on Michael Jordan in the heart of Magic Johnson. I mean, he really did like getting everybody involved.
Yeah, and it's really something, Terry. You know, he's always said, I'm not a scorer. Like, I'm not a scorer. I'm a player, and I do whatever it takes to win. And here he is going to be the all-time NBA scoring champion.
And by the way, he would never take part in the three-point – or I'm sorry, well, forget the three-point. He didn't belong there. The slam dunk contest. He just wouldn't. I'm sure he would have won that. And I heard Nike wanted him to do it, but he wouldn't do it, because he didn't want to be viewed as just a dunker. But the longevity thing, baseball would be maybe the one. I mean, there's a couple areas. You have Tom Brady, what he did in football, you know, into his 40s. Baseball, there's some players we'd have to go back and kind of look.
I cannot think, though, of another pro basketball player at such a high level bearing down on his 40th birthday like LeBron is.
Yeah, it's really something. And I wanted to mention this, Terry. Wouldn't this be something? Joe Varden, who works for The Athletic now and used to cover the Cavs for Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer, I saw him reporting today that LeBron has been working on a skyhook with his trainers the last couple of weeks. So wouldn't that be a tribute and kind of very LeBron if he set the record on a skyhook in tribute to Kareem? That would be classic, wouldn't it?
It would, David. And on top of that, LeBron was always respectful to former NBA players and those that went before him. I remember him telling me about watching tapes of Julius Erving. He was very interested in that. While Michael was his favorite player. In fact, when he was a sophomore, I remember interviewing him, and we got into size. He goes, I'm 6'6 and a half, because that's what Michael Jordan was listed as. So, and he had 23 all over, you know, that was on his wall. But even like when LeBron was a freshman, he averaged 20. They could have averaged more. Maverick Carter was the star of their team, who later became his business manager. And Maverick was a senior. And so those are the things that look, LeBron, you know, if you go back and you look at the rearview mirror of his career and that, if the worst thing he did was a stupid decision show when he went to Miami, and it was a bad move. If you really actually want to find out some, a lot of kind of cool stuff behind that, I wrote a lot about it in my book, The Comeback, about LeBron and the Cavs winning that title, which is a book I worked on for a year and a half before they won it. In fact, at one point in that year in 2016, David, it looked like they might get knocked out in the Eastern Finals by Toronto. And I was having a discussion with my publisher, David Gray, of like, well, maybe we just ought to hold this thing for another year, because I'm not sure. Come back to do that, you know. They came back and they knocked off, I think they were down 2-1 in that, and they knocked off Toronto and then took out Golden State. But there's a lot in there about how the decision thing came about, what he did. But I'm saying, so that's it, you know, in terms of, he said some dumb stuff along the way. When you interviewed all that much for 20 years, you're going to say some dumb things. But overall, it's pretty impressive. And on top of that, the I Promise School, the stuff that he's done here at LeBron James Foundation in Akron is impressive, and it's real, and it takes a lot of attention, not just money, but it personal attention from he and his people close to him.
Well said, Terry. All right, so it could happen tonight. The Lakers are playing in a 10 o'clock game against Oklahoma City out on the West Coast, so if it happens tonight, it might be late. And as for the Cavs, they are back at it on Wednesday night against Detroit. Then they're Friday at New Orleans, Saturday against the Bulls at home, another home game on Monday against the Spurs, and then back at it next Wednesday, Terry, against the Sixers in Philadelphia, which will be very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. Maybe a playoff matchup preview. You never know. So
I want to highlight, too, Jimmy Watkins, one of our new writers, wrote a really nice story on talking to people who coached and played against LeBron in high school. It's up on Cleveland.com, and I know they're going to be running it in the paper over the weekend. Very worth checking out.
All right. Thanks for that, Terry. Hey, let's take a break, right? When we come back, we're going to talk some Guardians. Terry was at the John Adams Services, and I also want to get his thoughts on spring training. We have some really fun emails from people. Yeah. Terry had this great idea last week where we started talking about Sean Payton and athletes we'd played against in our younger days, to have people send in some stories of who they've played against over the years. So we're going to read some of those. And then we've got some other Hey Terry questions, so we have time. So we'll be right back on Terry's Talking.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
We're back on Terry's Talking, David Campbell and Terry Pluto. All right, Terry, a couple of Guardians things to get into. Last week, you were honored as a choice to be a pallbearer for John Adams' funeral service, the longtime drummer for the Indians and Guardians. And I thought Paul Hoynes, our colleague, did a wonderful job capturing the kind of the moments of the day, and you were there. Why don't you talk for a minute about just what it was like and what you saw, and just the farewell to John Adams.
In a lot of ways, it was kind of like John's how John became an icon plumber, a guy who one day came with a drum to a game. Yes, they had the funeral mass downtown, and they planned a few things. They had bagpipes, but there were people out on the sidewalk just pounding a drum, reverentially, and sort of getting together. His music friends came out and just to pay tribute to him. I thought Vicky Arita, who was her husband were kind of the people that were helping John, basically the powers of attorney, close friends to the family and that, because John had very little family. She gave the eulogy, and one of the things she mentioned was that while John's middle name was Joseph, it should have been Volunteer, because John volunteered for things. In fact, this is a little bit of what I ended up doing a faith column about listening to that, because I was thinking about, first of all, if you're a fan, you actually are a volunteer. You're volunteering to follow whatever team you're volunteering. You're not really paid to do it. And John never was paid by the Tribe or the Guardians. He was given free tickets after several years, but he was never, quote, paid. And he was known for, teaching classes for disabled, swimming classes for disabled people at Cleveland State and raising money for all kinds of charity. That was him. He worked at AT&T. So it struck me as John was a volunteer, and there are a lot of the volunteers showed up to pay tribute to him. And it made me feel good. And what John did every day, and this struck me, when he went out, whether it was to a game, and I remember I visited him in a nursing home a few times, he volunteered to be a nice guy that day. And that's, people say, well, you think volunteering, I've got to go work at a shelter or whatever it is. Yeah, there's that stuff. But sometimes it's like, I'm volunteering not to be a jerk today. And so that's the thing that struck me about John and the funeral and what Vicky said.
All right, well, check out Terry's Faith in You column on Saturday and read about all that. And Terry, I think we talked about this last week, just the way he came to the team and to this vocation, as to tie into what you're saying, mm-hmm. We're probably never going to see anything like it again.
I doubt it.
And it was just, he did, he volunteered. And I think that's really well put. So, all right, Terry, we kind of started talking about Sean Payton and some other notable athletes that we have played against in our past. Did you think of anybody else that you ran across in your playing?
Anybody else that humiliated me? No, although I did get fouled in a basketball game, which was actually a controlled scrimmage by Lawrence Boston, who played at Cleveland JFK and then went on to play briefly in the NBA. And he was at John Kennedy High School when I was at Benedictine. And I made both free throws. That's it. It didn't even count. They just had those kind of scrimmages. We were in uniforms. They had the clock. But this was like these pre-whatever things you did before the real high school games counted. And whereupon I was sent back to the junior varsity.
Yeah, and mine was I played against Sean Payton in high school in the state football playoffs when I was back in the day. So, but you came up with this wonderful idea. You said we should have people send in stories of when they played with people. And boy, we got some really good ones here. So why don't we spend a few minutes on that? And I'll run through some of these. This one is from Dan Whitmer, who lives in Akron. And he says, hey, Terry and David, you were asking us to send in stories about sports players we played against. I had the chance to play against CJ McCollum and Costa Kufos when CJ was a freshman and Costa was a senior. Of course, Costa played at Ohio State. I played at Green and they played nearby at Glen Oak. Most people figured Costa was destined for the NBA because he was a 7-footer who was mobile and in high school had a nice shooting touch. No one would have predicted at the time that CJ would be in the NBA, let alone a perennial borderline all-star. He had great fundamentals, but he must have only been 5 feet tall. I then watched my brother go against CJ and Larry Nance Jr. at Revere. He graduated at the same time as Nance. Nance was also a late bloomer, similar to CJ. It has been an amazing time for people in Northeast Ohio making it to the NBA, and I didn't even mention LeBron. So thanks for that, Dan.
And to underline that point, Dave, McCollum went to Lehigh. I believe that was his only Division I grant. And my friend Larry Shiat,
who was just named the new coach at Wyoming, came and Larry Nash Jr. went there. And he said the only other Division I grant at that point that Larry Nash Jr. had was James Madison. So that does show it. Now, there was somebody else, by the way. I had one of those where you look at him, you never believe he'd make the big leagues. But I sat on the bench for those games. We played Collinwood in baseball when I was at Benedictine and sitting on that bench. And Jerry Dubzinski was a shortstop for Collinwood, who ended up going to Cleveland. He was this tall, real skinny kid with glasses. And you would never have guessed. I mean, he was a nice player at Collinwood. But, I mean, he went to Cleveland State. You know, he just sort of there and ends up being in the big leagues.
Yeah, and had a nice career and was a fan favorite here. So you there never you go. Know. So, all right, Dan, thanks for that letter. This next one is from Chris Greneau. Hope I said your last name right, Chris. He says, I played football for Menor between 1992 and 94. I played mostly special teams and backup outside linebacker. At 5 foot nothing and 100 nothing pounds, I was all heart and hustle. In 1993, we had a scrimmage against Sandusky. I got rotated in at outside linebacker for a series against their first team offensive line. And lo and behold, who am I lining up against? None other than 6 foot seven, 300 pound Orlando Pace. I'm pretty sure he let out a slight chuckle when we lined up. I'd love to say how I used my speed to get around him to sack the QB, but in reality, as I recall, I got pancaked once and otherwise did my best to hold my own, pancaked by the legendary Mr. Pancakes. So thanks there for that go. Letter, Chris. And Orlando Pace is probably, he's got to be one of the 10 best football players ever to come out of Ohio. You got to think, right, Terry?
Oh, yeah. and he survived the talk about it, so that's good.
That's right. All right, this next one is from Bruce Ebright from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. He says, hey, Terry, when my oldest son Daniel was 12 years old, he represented the state of Pennsylvania in a Cooperstown tournament in a teener league baseball event in 1999. David Price played for Florida, I believe. He had one at bat against him and struck out. Florida ended up winning the tournament. So that's an issue. That's a big name there.
Yeah,
I would not have the courage to stand in the box against David Price, I'll tell you that.
The one that I mentioned was Dave Tobik, who pitched pretty well for the Tigers relief and threw pretty hard. I still didn't see the three pitches that he blew by me. They were rumored. It was like a whoosh and a strike from the other mouth of the umpire. I think it just stood there staring at things that I couldn't see that I knew went by.
All right, there's the next one. This one is from Steven Pat. And Steven says, I played a preseason football game against Percy Snow, who was a linebacker for Canton McKinley. I was a receiver at Lake Catholic. I remember the hard tackle on a crossing route I caught. I also played with Scott Schaefer, who was a defensive coordinator at Stanford, Michigan, Syracuse, and head coach at Syracuse in 2013-15 in the Lake County Save a Sight All-Star football game, summer of 1985. Mm. He was a QB from Painesville Riverside, caught a couple passes from him, and we won the game. So, All right, thanks for that one, Steven. And let's see, we'll go down to this one. This one is from Darren Fry. He says, hey, Terry, you asked for honesty, so I have to admit this story belongs to my father and uncle. They'd send you the story, but they've already passed. I heard this story several times as a kid from them. Like everybody in rural Ohio, they played baseball. During Little League regional playoffs, they went up against Southern Sam McDowell. They lost 2-1. The only hit off McDowell was a solo home run my uncle hit. He always said it was luck because his eyes were closed.
Well, the late Mike Hegan, who used to do the Tribe games with Tom Hamilton, would say, once in a while, all of us would run into a fastball. What he meant, you're swinging a certain place, and if you just get that swing going early enough, and the ball just happens to be Austin Hedges would occasionally run into a fastball. It was not particularly intended. It just happened.
And Terry, so you know Bob Dolgan, longtime Cleveland sports writer, who I think now lives in Chicago. I think he gave Sudden Sam McDowell his nickname, if I remember the story.
Yes, he
correct.
Did.
Does that sound right to you?
Yes, he did. That's correct. He did give McDowell that nickname. And well, this is something that along playing there, when I was covering the Cavs for the Beacon Journal, they weren't supposed to do it, and they would never do it now, but back then, they didn't have 14 coaches and wannabe coaches on the staff. So sometimes the guys on the bench after practice where they would want to play run full court. so they wouldn't get a couple of writers, PR guys, and we were out there. I mean, I remember one game, I was out in the backcourt with Steve Kerr. My whole job was bring the ball off the floor. Steve was practicing running around picks to catch it and just catch and shoot, catch and shoot. And Derek Chivas was in that game, and I think Winston Bennett, a couple other guys. I mean, we knew we had to stay out of their way, but now it would never happen. And just imagine, like, if one of those guys had stepped on my foot or something and sprained an ankle. It would have been bad.
Yeah, you would have gotten the scoop anyway.
Yeah, I would have. Yeah, that would have been the last for all of us. We'd probably been banned for the gym forever. So,
a different era for sure. So, all right, we got two more here, Terry. This one is from Chris Fernandez. He says, "Hey, Terry, my story, Alex Cora. Our team from Antilles High School in Fort Buchanan, Puerto Rico, played local high school teams, and his was one of the teams that we played against from his hometown in Caguas, which is C-A-G-U-A-S. I hope I said that right. I was a part-timer, mostly a scorekeeper, until my senior year when I finally got some playing time as a pitcher. I figured this would be low-level enough to count without seeming outlandish, LOL. Oh, and one more story. I've been a personal trainer for 25 years, and in that time also worked with major leaguers. Troy Tulowitzki was one of my clients, and one time he brought Nolan Arenado, who was a minor leaguer at the time in the Rockies season, to train and work out with us. And he says you can verify it all at his website, chrisfernandez.com. So thanks for that one.
He did not tell us how he did when he pitched to Cora. I mean, that's waiting for what happened.
We'll have to get that. Send us another email, Chris. We'll update that next week. So, and here's the last one, Terry. It's from Lou Boyd, and he says, "Hey, Terry, I batted against Bob Feller in 2002 at Indians Fantasy Camp. I hit a soft liner back to Bob, which he knocked down and threw me out at first. At the time, Bob would face batters from each team during the pros versus campers game. Typically, they selected the older players to face him. I certainly qualified in that category. Having a photo and video of that experience, I'm constantly reminding my relatives that I batted against a Hall of Fame pitcher." And again, that's from Lou Boyd. So thanks for
definitely
that.
Definitely counts.
It does. I bet Bob still had a little bit of gas on the fastball.
Yeah. Bob would sign that ball for you if you happen to have $10.
Oh, so thanks, Joe. Hey, if you have any more you want to send us, we'd love to keep this going for another couple of weeks. You can send that to sports@cleveland.com and just put "Hey Terry" or "Terry's Talking" in the headline, and we will try to get it on next week's podcast. So, all right, Terry, we're running a little behind here. I wanted to get to some "Hey Terry" questions. We've got some good ones here.
Okay.
And the first one is from Paul Cosgrove from Stowe, longtime friend of the podcast. And he says, "Hey, Dave and Terry, do you think Trevor Stephan should be given a shot at the Guardians starting rotation? As you know, Stephan was a Rule 5 acquisition from the Yankees a few seasons ago. He's been in the bullpen since joining the team and has improved every year. Last year, he had stretches where he would go a number of games without allowing a base runner. Mm-hmm. I know he is very valuable as a reliever, but he could be a 2 or 3 in the Guardians rotation. What do you think?"
There's no plans to do it that I know of. They believe that the turnaround for him was to get him into the bullpen because he had been a starter in the minors with the Yankees. He has a split finger, which has really helped him move up. I think with the value they put on relievers right now, their feeling is, especially Francona, can never have enough pitchers and relief pitchers, and they'd rather be looking at Gavin Williams and Bibby, B-I-B-E-E, and the minors, I always say his last name, right? And a couple of these others. You know, Spino, they keep hyping him. This guy's got to stay healthy, David, before I'm on the Daniel Spino trade. He's got to, like, pitch 100 innings in the minors or something, you know. Clearly, his stuff is overwhelming, but they got to keep him together. I mean, a concern on the Guardians is your fourth and fifth starters are Savali and Plesac. And you look at how they have pitched the last couple of years, it's not very good. In fact, when you look at their record last year, you go, how the heck did they ever win 92 games? I think these guys are like 12-20 or something.
All right. Thanks for that question, Paul. And you're right. I think the Guardians have long-term plans for all these guys. And it seems like when they find success, they like to keep a guy in that role usually, right?
Yeah. And a lot of it, too, was he was drafted specifically from their reports to go into the bullpen. So that's why they took him. So it wasn't as if they thought, well, we'll just throw him there because see if we can get him together
and have him turn around and then start later on. But, you know, to my point, I just wanted to kind of circle back. I mean, if you look at, I mean, last year, Savali and Plesac were combined 5-18 with an ERA of around 4.6. How the heck did they ever win 92 games? It's pretty phenomenal, you know, but it was the bullpen that really carried them through all that. Now, a guy that I like, by the way, is Cody Morris quite a bit. Now, they're going to prepare him in spring training. I was talking to Chris Antonetti about this as a starter, but they could plug him into the bullpen. They just like having those dominating arms, you know, with Karinchak and Class A. And like they still like Eli Morgan. Morgan would be a spot starter if they wanted to do that. All right, Stefan on his numbers to the point. 82 strikeouts in 63 innings. I mean, that's really good. The other thing you like is only 3 home runs in those 63 innings. So a lot of good stuff, 2.69 ERA. But Sam Hetkins, another guy who they love forever as a starter, they put him in the bullpen, and he had a 2.32. I remember watching him, and I just said, I don't see the second round pick. I don't see it. His stuff is all over the place. He's wild. He was a mechanical nightmare, a big, long lefty. But he figured it out in relief. So I don't think they want to mess with success.
All right. Well, I'm really looking forward to you going to spring training, Terry. I know you're going to be looking at a lot of these guys. I can't wait to hear your impressions. And you and Roberta have always come up with somebody like one
or two
names.
She's the one who got on to Steve Kwan. I was on Owen Miller.
<That's right>.
So
we'll see what you come back with when you're out there in a few weeks. So, all right, here's one more, Terry. It's from Jefferson Wolf from Chester, Virginia. And Jefferson says, hey, Terry, the Guardians always seem to find pitchers on the scrap heap every year. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on any of their spring invitees and maybe specifically Tuki Toussaint, who looks as if he may be a good candidate for the Guardians pitching factory? I enjoy the podcast every week.
I heard they like him. I've not seen him. But when you talk about that, and who at this point would have said, I could never get his first name right, Envel De Los Santos, E-N-V-E-L, De Los Santos. And there's another guy. He was 5-0 with a 3.04. There's your rummage sale, you know, winner of the year for them. Along with, I would also say Hetkins was that too. Now he was well known to them, but I remember De Los Santos. I remember them telling me about him in spring training, and I'm like, yeah, well, so what? You know, is it because they always have a number of those guys in there? They've tried to have Anthony Ghost be that guy, but Ghost is now coming off of Tommy John surgery. So, and then I see another name, the guy that they did like. It didn't really come through. Remember Anthony Castro? That was not good. Well, that's what I mean. You kind of throw them all together and see who comes out.
Yeah, just for a little background on Toussaint, Terry, for those who aren't familiar, it's Tuki Toussaint, T-O-U-K-I, T-O-U-S-S-A-I-N-T. Spent some years in the Braves organization and was in the Angels organization last year. And he does, you're right, he kind of fits the mold of kind of the big, you know, 6'3", 215, righty.
And he's been in some big trades. People like him, have liked him, but he hasn't just done that much.
He's going to be 27 this year, and last season with the Angels, 1-1, 4.62 ERA, 8 games, 25 innings pitched, gave up 2 home runs, 19 walks, and 26 strikeouts. So anyway, a name to watch, and thanks for bringing that up. So we appreciate the question.
Well, what he can do is when this guy makes the team and is playing well early in the year, he can send us an email and say, I told you so. I'm as good a scout as your wife, Roberta.
All right. I think we're about time to wrap up, Terry. Do you have a book recommendation you want to mention this week? Anything you want to, or something else? A book or something else.
Well, I like a writer named Richard Whitlow, W-H-I-T-L-O-W. He's considered kind of the Christian John Grisham. And I read a book of his called Relative Justice that I like, but I think you could really find him online. And if you like Grisham stuff, you'll like his. Most of them are set in the South in Georgia. He was a practicing attorney for years in the state of Georgia. And really, some Christian fiction is terrible and some is really good. And because it's sort of like when you hear that, go, oh, well, that means it doesn't, there's no grit to it or anything. No, just the opposite. His stories are good. He's a good storyteller. Richard Whitlow.
Yeah, and it's always, you can tell when someone is an expert in something else and they bring that expertise into the writing, you can tell the fiction is going to be good because it's actually based in experiences that the person has had and they know what they're talking about. So
that's like interesting. A writer I do like too, Michael Connelly, writes a lot of the Harry Bosch things, a lot of very big selling writer there. What he does, he's got a whole kind of stable of the, well, first of all, he covered the police beat for the LA Times. That started it. And he actually had done the police beat before that in Fort Lauderdale, I believe. Then he moved to LA. And then he got to be friends with these detectives. And as he began writing novels, he kind of put them like, they go out. They tell stories. He buys them beer and food. I'm sure he pays them as researchers. And then he just comes up with stuff. And that's why when he'll be moving his novel along, there'll be some weird side story of, you know, how some guy solved the crime because he found some soggy, you know, chocolate chip cookies in the middle of a muffler or just these weird things. You know, they're so off the wall that they've got to be true. My friends in law enforcement that I would talk to say when they're talking to somebody, they go, that is the dumbest excuse. Who would think of that? And then they go, maybe he's actually telling the truth because it's so dumb and so off the wall, you know, that maybe it's right. It
might actually be true.
Yeah, it might actually be true. Dumb enough to be true.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Terry. Terry mentioned his The Comeback book earlier. If you want to check out any of Terry's books, you can go to terrypluto.com and find that there. And just to give a plug to cleveland.com, we would love to have you subscribe. We need all the help we can get to support journalism. Just the easiest way to do it, and you'll get a lot of cool Brown stuff if you do it this way too, is go to cleveland.com/browns. Click on the blue bar at the top, and you can become a subscriber. You get a Browns newsletter. You get our Browns subtext service where our reporters will text you from out in the field when they're covering stuff. It's a great time to get in with the combine and the draft coming up. So there's two plugs. I think that's it, Terry. We done any other things to plug here? We good?
That is it for now.
All right.
See if we have anybody else who like got a double off of Nolan Ryan or anything.
Yeah. Send us some more stories. We'd love to have those. Again, you can send those to sports@cleveland.com. That'll do it for this week. Don't let anybody put chocolate chip cookies in your tailpipe.
Yeah.
And we will catch you next week on Terry's Talking.